Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore and our favorite media. I'm your host, Joe Perez, one of several lore-focused folks from Blizzard Watch, and I've got my stupendous co-host with me today, Matt Rossi. How are you doing today, Matt?
I am eating a pizza, as is required in my culture, so you know who I'm descended from.
We're going to get into that in a second, because we have a topic for at least the beginning of this episode, folks. But for those of you at home, if you have a question for this podcast or any of our podcasts, or if you have a topic you want us to cover, you feel free to send those in to podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Specify which show it's for so that we know. If you don't want to send us an email, you can go ahead and send us those topics and questions to our Discord channels. We have one set aside for our Patreon supporters at Patreon Q and podcast questions. And if you're not a Patreon supporter, again, we understand, but you still want to send us something on Discord, we do have our Q and podcast questions channel. Be sure, again, to specify what show they're for. We are going to get to some questions today, possibly, but we're going to start today with a topic that, well, last night kind of got me on a little bit of a tirade, and I felt it was something that we should talk about a little bit today. And it's cultural representation in media. Now, the reason that this comes up, and I'm not going to mince words about it, is that National Hispanic Heritage Month for the United States is coming up and starts on September 15th and ends on October 15th. And during this time frame, usually, we get lots of companies doing what they do, the same thing they do with Pride Month, is trying to directly target audiences and show that they're, you know, they care about us or whatever the case is. Some companies do this better than others, and some companies do this all year round. And it's definitely reflective in media at the time. Reason this came up is because DC Comics, one of the comic companies that have really been formative for a lot of us, has revealed some special covers for some of their Hispanic characters, which all appear to be very caricature-ish and very stereotypical and don't actually really highlight what it is to be, in this case, Hispanic. And I'm looking at Blue Beetle with swinging through the air or flying through the air with burritos. Kyle Rayner, who is, you know, Hispanic, standing with a Viva La Mexico flag, bag of tamales. Because I know that when I want to look at my heritage, that's the first thing I look for, is what kind of food they're eating. This goes to the top of the comment that Matt made earlier. Now, it is a tricky subject because everybody is going to feel a very certain way about it. And I want to preface this by saying these are all our opinions. And you will certainly have your own. But I do feel very strongly about this, especially if you've listened to any of our podcasts. You know why characters like Miles Morales mean a lot to me and why representation in a proper manner matters. What do you think, Matt?
What do I think? Okay. I feel like I'm going to start this with something I don't think should be controversial, but seems like it might. If you are a white person and you are going to in some way portray people who are not white, you should be doing some research. And especially for something that is the cover to a comic book here in this case. Your cover does not have a plot. It's a cover. You have an image. And that image, there's ways to for that image to honor the heritage of the characters. I've recently, that both DC and Marvel have done Pride Months. And those were actually pretty good for the most part. I'm looking at some of these covers for the DC Heritage, the Hispanic Heritage Month. Here's the question, the current question, who's, I believe it's Detective Montoya has
it
become
is,
the question.
It is Detective Montoya.
She's got, I think it's, I don't know what country's flag it is, I'm sorry, but the flag's behind her, and that's fine. And then she's surrounded by fruit. Why is she surrounded by fruit? Are they, you know, they're fruits. That's great. You couldn't come up with anything else for her to be doing than standing there surrounded by fruit. But let's now move over to Hawk Girl, who in this one, it's the Multiversity Teen Justice Hispanic Heritage Month variant. So I'm assuming this is a Hawk Girl from that comic. She is wearing an apron and picking up a bunch of fritos. She's picking
fried,
up a
fried
bunch
plantains.
Of, yeah, she's picking up a bunch of trays at the window to apparently be the waitress and bring them to other people. That's the cover for her. For Task Force Z, Hispanic Heritage Month cover, we have Bane. Bane is Hispanic. Remember that. Bane is from South America. I believe he's from an island prison sort of thing. And his, to honor his heritage, there yet again, he's having some food. He is eating something. I can't even see what it is. It's too small. But there's a chef next to him looking very upset. Apparently he's stiffed the bill or something. I can't tell. I mean,
yeah, Bane let's not talk about that either. Cause like yeah. That's clearly we all of us Hispanic folks stiffed the bill. Cause that's what's part
of
our heritage.
I mean,
is,
it
right?
Also looks like he's killed a bunch of people in the room. Also so possibly true. He's just mad about that. I don't know, but here we go. There's the Blue Beetle cover. He's eating, I think, burritos. Honestly, these are so poorly drawn. I couldn't tell what kind of food they are, but regardless, yeah, he's jumping around and eating because, you know, Mexican people. Jumpy and Edie. Then we have Jessica Cruz, whose cover would be fine. Big hammer, bunch of supervillains on the ground. That'd be fine. Except that she is, of course, also eating what looks to be a
taco burrito hybrid.
Yeah, we don't know what that is. But again, it's eating because that's what they do. Finally, for Blood Syndicate, Hispanic Heritage Month, I don't recognize the character. He has a 9 on his arm. I don't know who he is. But I mean, they're having some kind of family dinner thing. This is the best one because they're doing something. And it's kind of cool to show them all together having some kind of dinner. That would be fine. I mean, except for the fact that all the covers so far have involved food. The Kyle Rayner one is even worse because he's just standing there. Originally, he was standing there holding his power ring with a Mexican flag behind him and creating symbols with the ring. And an homage to an actual painting. I don't recognize the painting. I believe you, Joe, you said it was a mural named La Patria.
Yeah, it was La Patria, which was, it's a very famous mural by Jorge Gonzalez. It's something that I know a lot of folks from Mexico actually look at, and it's supposed to represent, like, again, that the soul of like what it is to be Mexican. And yes, it does have some food in it, but it is not prominent. It is got the symbol of the eagle carrying the snake. It has the Mexican flag. It has icons of Mexico City, icons of the Aztec nation, and everything else like that surrounded these areas, and sort of like is a encapsulation of the history of that, with a strong Mexican woman holding the flag.
And they switched it to Kyle Rayner holding a bag of tamales.
And there is some controversy around it because there was, and Jorge Miller did the original cover, and it was absolutely fantastic. And then it ran into some legal trouble, but instead of rectifying the legal trouble, they went with the path of least resistance. The reason we're talking about this and making such a big deal out of it is, one, this is very important to me. You know, not that I need a month to feel good about my Hispanic heritage or anything like that, but it's not like we get representation every day, all day. So having something that celebrates that side of my life, I'm all about. I think it's, I generally look forward to it. When Marvel does it, these are the heroes that are Hispanic being displayed prominently doing hero stuff, but acknowledging their heritage, whether it's traditional dress or whether it's, I don't think I've seen one cover that has food.
Like, yeah, no, Marvel doesn't do that. What Marvel does is promote a man to editor-in-chief who pretended to be Japanese for several years.
That's a whole other thing. So
let's not pretend that Marvel is...
Again, they're not perfect. They're not perfect.
But this cover, the cover we actually got of Kyle Rayner would be okay. Not great, but okay, if not for the bag of tamales.
The plastic, what is referred to as a gas station bag of tamales.
Yeah, just and some of them are floating out of the bag, but you know, whatever. There's no gravity in space. I guess you shouldn't bring your tamales there.
It was Jorge Molina, not Jorge Miller.
Yeah,
apologies.
It's just so the flag he's got holding now just says "Viva Mexico" on it, like a tourist banner. Which, okay, wouldn't be my first choice, but you know, it's kind of hard to make a Mexican flag with a green power ring. Admittedly, there's more than one color in the Mexican flag, but. Still, I feel like this is it's tone deaf in that way that people who just they don't know anything about what they're doing, and this isn't Molina's fault at all.
No,
because he didn't finish the cover before they told him not to do it.
Even his quote, he made a tweet that said, "One of these has my signature, the other one doesn't." That's all I can say about
it. Yeah, it's just it is tone deaf, and it is something that could have been avoided fairly easily. And the fact that every single cover of the seven I've now seen involves food. One of them, literally, she's just standing there surrounded by fruit. The question beats people up. I mean, that's what she does. She should be beating someone up. Hawk Girl uses a mace and flies around and beats people up. Bane, okay, sure, Bane's hungry after, I think, killing a bunch of people. Sure, he'd stop to eat, I guess. I feel like there could have been one or two covers with food. The only one that I feel like is justified is the Blood Syndicate cover.
Yeah, because
that's an actual family thing. Like, look, you know, they're standing around. They're having a dinner together. They're all taking part in it. That I'm okay with. But when you then add the fact that literally every cover here, of these seven covers, every single one of them has somebody eating or food heavily prominently involved. Now it's weird. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And it's the reason that I bring this up is because, again, I'm not saying that it is an easy thing to represent cultures if you are not familiar with them. But there's something that we have access to now that maybe we didn't have 50, 60, 70 years ago. And that is a plethora of people in this industry that you can talk to or in any industry that you can bring on to advise you. And in fact, there has been several movies and TV shows that have done exactly this and brought in people that are of that culture to advise, to make sure that they're not doing the tone deaf responses, that they are being accurate in it. Things like, I think it's Reservation Dogs. They actually had people come on that are of that culture and advise on it. You have people who work in the comic industry that are part of these cultures, bringing them in to advise, like, okay, this is fine for art, or maybe stick away from this stereotype, or here's a better. And the kicker for some of this stuff is, like, Kyle Rayner as a story, it's really well done how he finds out how he is Hispanic. The story and the revelation of his father leading the double life to try to keep himself safe, where the Rayner name comes from, why, you know, who he actually is, him learning about his culture, him integrating his culture into his personality slowly as he learns about it over time. It is actually really well done. And stuff like this sort of takes away from the fact that the actual content of the book isn't tone deaf. And it's just, this is an imploring, if anything else. Characters like Miles Morales do well because they embrace their heritage in a way that feels genuine. It's not just there for dressing. It's not just there to sell a book 1 month out of the year or to say, hey, look, we are actually sensitive to our folks. Here's whatever stereotype isn't going to get us sued. It's showing the care and identity for what you're portraying in those characters, actually understanding what those cultures are, and getting that sort of direction and asking those questions of folks that are from that culture. It is exceptionally important.
Yeah, I don't have anything to say on that other than yes, it's important. And if nothing else, Like, you don't even need to, for these covers, there doesn't need to be anything on them that specifically suggests anything about the people's culture. Mm-hmm. If that's what you don't want to do, fine, don't do it. Just show them being themselves. Just show them doing the things they do, and the fact that they're Hispanic will be enough. Although I certainly think it would have been nice if they'd actually tried to tie it in. Yeah. One of the things that really bugs me is that in a lot of cases, you know, not every Hispanic character is Mexican or eats their native cuisine isn't necessarily tamales.
Yeah, that's
a weird whole other burrito things. Like, you know, it's like if so characters from Puerto Rico, they're very different than Mexico. You know, there's the Dominican Republic. There's like dozens of nations that someone of Hispanic heritage can come from. Yeah, it can be, you know, and it's not necessarily first or second generation either. Like, you can come from, like, you can be the grandchild of someone who came from Mexico and someone who came from Ecuador. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all these different permutations. The idea that you just slap some tamales on it or burritos or whatever the heck these lumpy things they're all eating are supposed to be. No, I'm sorry. That's just ridiculous. Just show them. It's clueless. And it's like I said, you know, it's like I am eating a pizza to show my Italian heritage. Technically, I'm of Italian heritage. I've got like quite a few. I'm a mutt. I'm an American mutt. My mother's parents both came over. My grandfather was from Scotland. My grandmother was from Ireland. I've got a lot of relatives over there that I don't know and have never met. But I don't go around, you know, I don't generally eat haggis to show my Scottish heritage. Do you know what I'm saying? It's just, no, this is not good.
And this is not to beat a dead horse, so to speak. It's just to shed light on it. It's one of those things where I think some folks take it for granted, but it's something that comics were a big part of my life. So in particular, when comic books get it wrong, it hurts, especially when it's maybe characters that I grew up with or maybe characters that mean something to me, especially. It hurts a little bit more. And some people may think that's an overreaction, but I that's just how I feel. And it's the same thing with movies and TV shows. When I see the generalization that all, like a lot of TV shows for a very long time, if they try to portray a Hispanic character, it didn't matter where they were from. They were just Mexican. That was it. That was the end of it. Now we've moved past that, thankfully, and there's further diversity there. But that's the type of stuff that, until people pushed back on, didn't get changed. And when things get missed like this or things feel like they're done without care, it bothers me. Because, again, you have people that work in these industries that are of these cultures that literally can advise you and talk to you through it. And like, no, this isn't how it is. This isn't what it is. So I'm not going to talk too much more about that, but it's just in the world of storytelling, in the world of lore and creating universes and worlds and characterizations, we can still do better. And it is my hope that the backlash from this will force them to do better, because I want them to do better. I want everybody to do better because we all deserve it, every single one of us out there. So I'm going to move on now, and we're going to go ahead and start talking about some questions. Again, send them in if you have them. But this one is going to come from Talvi. There is a priest in the Legion class hall that became a paladin. Has this been explored at all before in the story of Warcraft, and do you think it is something we might see in the future? Also, she was a night elf. Do you think that paladin night elves could be a thing since we have blood elves? Would they be servants of the Sunwell or a loon or something entirely different? Talvi, we talked about this a little bit in the past, and I'm not going to go into the history because I'm going to let Matt do that a little bit. But there is sort of a precedent, I believe, beyond just the one Night Elf Paladin to open the doorway for more, especially after the events of everything that occurred in Shadowlands with everything with the Night Warrior, showing how Alun does bestow power, and Alun is, at her core, a source of light. So there is the possibility that we could, and it is my hope that we would see potentially more Night Elf Paladins, because why not at this point? The light is varied. The light is different. We've seen Sunwalkers who worship Anshi the Sun, right? They worship an entity that is light, but is not the light. We've seen Paladins from Dazar Allure who worship Loa. It's not necessarily the light. We've seen that paladins can be any number of things as long as they internalize that sort of fusion of devotion and reverence to what they're praying to, essentially, or what they're getting their source of power from, with martial prowess. And I believe in the past we have talked about priests becoming paladins, and this is where I'll turn it over to Matt.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of debate as to the whole concept of the light versus, you know, where you're getting your particular power from. It's quite possible that the Loa are, in fact, tapping into the light. We know that the Titans tap into the light. We've seen them do it. If you remember the Siege of Orgrimmar raid, when you go through into the Vale of Eternal Sorrows and you fight the Noroshen encounter, is him summoning monsters to fight you and then, you know, using the light to purify you. That's him doing that. He's a Titan construct and he uses the light. Tyr, who is essentially the former because he's dead, not because he was kicked out, but Tyr, the Titan Watcher, who essentially helped humanity survive when the Curse of Flesh was changing the Rykul into what are now humans. Tyr, his life and his passing have clearly affected humanity and their idea of what a paladin is. And Tyr himself seemed to have been able to channel the light as well. So there's that. But in terms of priests becoming paladins, obviously the first Draenei paladins, I don't know if that's how that went. But I do know that the first human paladins were all priests, except for one of them. Of the various people who became paladins, everyone except Taralion was already a priest. Taralion was a knight. He was just as religious as them, but he hadn't taken priestly orders. The others had, even Uther. And when they became paladins, obviously Taralion had to gain instruction in the light and how to channel it and wield it. And everybody else had to get instruction in combat. Basically how to be a warrior, how to use a weapon. And paladins that humanity had, the first five, Taralion, Uther, Gavinrad the Dire, Satan Dathrathan, and Tyrion Fordring, except for Taralion, those other four were all priests. And there's others in the lore as well. Lady Liadrin, who is essentially the first Blood Elf paladin, she was also a priest. She was a priest of the light. And when her people were destroyed, she lost her faith. Like when the Scourge came up and carved their way through Silvermoon and went to the Isle of, and, you know, despoiled the Sunwell, she lost her faith, which is not surprising because, you know, she'd done her best. She'd prayed to the light, and yet they failed, and so many people were killed and so much was lost. So she lost her faith. And then when Ramath came back with the captured Nauru, they started the process of siphoning power from him. And she was one of the first to be entrusted with that power. And she became the first Blood Knight or first Blood Elf Paladin. After the events of Burning Crusade, when basically Velen purified the new Sunwell that was made with Muru's essence, she basically had realized, oh, what we've been doing, we tortured this being of pure light for months, and yet he still trusts us with his essence. He trusts us to take forth the light into the future. So she kind of reconciled with the light and is now basically at this point, Blood Elf Paladins no longer drain the light essence from a captured Nauru. They are paladins. She's reconnected with the light. The new ones that they train never start off from that negative place. They all start off as paladins. So you've got that. That's another priest who became a paladin. And whilst Eponine Brightmane wasn't a priest because Torin didn't have priests, Torin got priests and paladins at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And from the same source. The priests that exist now in the Shuhalo, in the Torin, are dedicated to Anshe just as the paladins are. And they have a shared source, although they didn't start off like, no, there were no Torin priests to become paladins and vice versa. There were no Torin paladins to exist in the first place. But you can honestly say that of the groups that have have paladins currently in game, the Draenei, we have no idea. The dwarves have both priests and paladins. We don't know if one came from the other or if they've just always had both. The dwarven paladins tend to be based around Titan lore, in much the same way that the human ones are. Just the human ones are based around Tyr, and the dwarven ones are based around ancestors. like literally the dwarves that came before and the dwarves that came before them, going all the way back to before they were dwarves. There's clearly a lot of influence there. But humans, priests who became paladins, blood elves, priests who became paladins, Tauren, both priests and paladins at the same time from the same basic source. Lightforged, obviously the Lightforged are kind of in a special case of their own. Zandalar, definitely different in terms of how they got their power. They draw it from their relationship with Razan originally.
Mm-hmm.
And now, who knows? I mean, they didn't lose their powers when Razan died. I'm doing finger quotes. You can't see me, but that's that. They didn't lose their power when Razan died. And now that Vol'jin is the Loa of Kings, will they be drawing power from him? That's a good question. I don't have an answer to it. But for your next part, do you want to talk more now and I'll come back in? By the way, Delis Moonfang is the Night Elf Priestess who became a paladin.
That is correct.
That's her name. Just wanted to throw that out there.
It's an interesting thing because we've seen that, again, anybody who has that relationship with a light or a source of power that sort of fills that same role is capable of becoming a paladin. So the door is there. It's open. And with the way that the storytelling has been going, I think it's a really good opportunity, especially if they started to explore that in sort of the story going forward, especially now. The Night Elves are at a point of trying to rebuild. They're trying to recover everything that happened with Shadowlands, which I think is important too, because I think Taranda's relationship with the Loon is forever changed. I think there is new understanding, deeper understanding on what a Loon is and what that looks like moving forward. But again,
yeah, but also it's not just understanding. A Loon valued Taranda enough to choose her as her high priest 10,000 years ago during the invasion of the Legion.
And then now, valued her enough to not let her burn herself out.
When Taranda became the Night Warrior, she was supposed to die. It kills people. And there's literally no way to stop it. Two people tried to share it once to keep it from killing the first one, and that didn't work. And we see here that Loon so valued Taranda that at the moment where she would have killed her enemy and succumbed, you could see that the Night Warrior power was like leaking off of her. It was coming down her face. It had replaced her markings.
Mm-hmm.
At that moment, not to spare Sylvanas, because Loon don't give two beeps about Sylvanas, but to spare Taranda, a Loon let go. Imagine you find out that the god you serve values your life so much that they will not let you die if they can avoid it. That's going to change your relationship with your deity. And I think that is something that a story of Night Elves becoming paladins would be something you could explore that story with it.
I would agree. But I think I don't have much else to add to that because I think you've covered all the bases, unless there's anything else you want to add.
I can't, like I said, I can't think of any other paladins that we have currently that either did or didn't have priests, but we've seen it happen enough times. We've seen it happen at least twice, possibly three times, depending on how you view the Tauren situation. We've seen it enough times that we know that it is something that happens. It has happened before. It could absolutely happen again. It should happen again. I also think it would be interesting to explore this whole idea of beings who touch the light, who act as intercessors. Because it's one thing, human paladins seem to literally go straight to the source, as do Draenei paladins and Lightforged Draenei paladins. But dwarves go through their ancestors. Everything a dwarf paladin does is ancestral.
Mm-hmm.
They're touching their ancestors who touched the light. The Tauren thing is not just ancestral, but also Anshay, the light being. The blood elf thing is now straight up touching the light, but they went through a period of having a Naru that they used as kind of an intercessor, a way around being like the way you paladins usually are. And then they converted to being paladins, and all current blood elf paladins are not drawing from a Naru because they don't have a Naru to draw from anymore. They're drawing from the Sunwell and from the light itself. So there's intercessors in some cases, the Loa for the Zandalar paladin. Sorry, I could not see Zandalar for a second. My brain just was like, nope, I don't know that word. There's a lot to this that could come up in the future. I hope that they do something about it with the Vol'jin story. I hope Vol'jin's story going forward touches on that. And if we got like regular old troll paladins, it would not be a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
If like they draw upon Vol'jin and you see trolls becoming paladins, I would think that was pretty cool. For that matter, I absolutely think that night elves, and not only do I think night elves should get paladins, I would like to see elves and trolls actually have some sort of meeting where they get at least a little into the idea that they are kin.
Yeah.
That there's something there. They are related. They need to start actually having cross. Like, honestly, I would like to see if the Nightborn story moves forward. One of the things I'd like to see is her, them actually reaching out to the night elves and saying, you know, after all that, I really feel like we should talk, you know, that this hostility between us is not serving any purposes. But just in general, I would like to see that touching in on the story of the light and these intercessors.
I would agree. All right. I'm going to move on to our next question here. And this is a little bit of a longer one. So I was wondering whether you think we'd hear about Terragosa in Dragonflight. I know her story was technically wrapped up, but I don't think it's truly finished. As you know from Cataclysm Quest, Terragosa sacrifices herself to save Caligos after Aragos wanted Calic's death, as it was a means to secure his succession to the aspect of the Blue Dragonflight. Caligos then saves her by binding her soul to the player character, and we eventually bind her to a staff where her spirit lives on for all eternity. This sounds like a wrap-up for a story, but I think there's room for more. Caligos, when on the Actionable Intelligence quest, states that Terragosa was born under a special sign that foretold of a great destiny. While one could argue saving Calic and contributing to the selection of the new aspect, as we take her from form to attend the Draconic Council, is very big, Is it truly that great of a destiny to warrant no further story with her? Especially since we will definitely see Calic, and he had a very special relationship to Terragosa. I think there is more that could be done in Dragonflight, and I wanted to hear y'all's take. For example, could we find a way to restore her to a living form post Shadowlands knowledge and allow her to truly have a great destiny? And this is from Ave Riella from Moonguard. So this is an interesting one, because Shadowlands, now that we know what happens when an entity dies, or at least we have an idea, and we know that dragon spirits, even aspects, can be sent there, as we saw with Ysera, maybe putting her in a staff and having her soul and consciousness sort of bound to an artifact of immense power might, I mean, it definitely circumvents that death process. But now that we're going back to the Dragon Isles, where there is absolutely a Titan facility, and we're starting to learn things about how the dragons became empowered to begin with, there might be something there that maybe we could take her soul and her personality and reactivate her, or do a Titan construct in the same way that Earthen or the original Vrykul or any of the other races that are constructed via stone have souls imbued within them and eventually become essentially living creatures. They're not necessarily just programmed entities. And we even know that the entities of the Pantheon of Death, even though they are technically shells that have been programmed with souls and feelings and knowledge, are living entities in and of themselves in a lot of ways. There's a possibility for it. Do I think it's very likely? I don't think so. I think instead what we're going to wind up finding out is a lot more about the Blue Dragonflight in general. I think we're going to find out more about their relationship with the other Dragonflights, because don't forget, our introduction to the Blue Dragonflight outside of Caligos was, oh, they're going to take all the magic away from us. We should probably go kill the crazy guy that's, you know, doing that and, you know, potentially hurting the planet in the process of doing so. To now we're basically getting involved in their internal politics to ensure that Caligos gets selected as the aspect. By the way, here's one of their greatest members that we are now charged with being bound with their soul, then taking their soul and shoving it into an artifact, and then, you know, moving on with our lives. To what we learned about in Azuna, with how sort of that relationship goes there with their sort of, again, I want to say dependence on magic, but like their deep connection to the arcane. But now we're going to their homeland. We're going to where their Dragonflight was essentially roosted for forever. We get to learn what experiments they were working on. We get to learn how they viewed all the other Dragonflights, what they viewed as their position among all of them. And they are absolutely critical. I'm not going to spoil anything, but they are crucial to at least the Drakthyr story. We know that for a fact. And Calagos is absolutely around because all of the dragon aspects are around. All of the dragonflights are around because this is the first time they've been able to go home in 10,000 years or however long it's been. It's been a while. So what do you think, Matt?
I didn't notice if you'd read the PS. Did you read the PS?
I did not, but we can always go with that after.
I'm going to just read the PS right now so I can talk about the thing I want to talk about.
Sure.
The PS was, between Taragosa and Avina and Jaina, Kallak, despite literally having wings, desperately needs a good wingman. Taragosa was more like a little sister to him. Avina, yeah, he had the hots for Avina. He wanted to dip himself into the Sunwell, let's say, although she wasn't the Sunwell at that particular moment. She had been the Sunwell previously. Good job there, Kallak. Jaina, I never understood the Jaina Calagos relationship. Straight up never understood it. But I'm going to point out you left somebody out. Taragosa. Taragosa is the daughter of Malagos.
Mm-hmm.
She is one of the, for lack of a better word, she's one of the last remaining children of Malagos. And with her brother Argos dead, she's got a good claim to that being in charge of the Dragonfleet now that we don't have an aspect anymore. Although there does definitely seem to be some stuff going on in Dragonfleet that may make that different. However, I will say this. Taragosa has popped up again. We've seen her in Burning Crusade when she's the one that actually brought the Nether Dragons to Malagos' attention. And she actually even introduced a Nether Dragon to Malagos, which is the event that caused him to go from crazy in a depressed, not doing anything, just sitting around being feeling sorry for himself way too crazy and I will control all magic in the world and prevent mortals from doing any more damage sort of way. So Taragosa was central to those events. If not for Taragosa bringing Malagos Nether Dragons to look at and to accidentally absorb some power from, that wouldn't have happened. Now, you can argue that wasn't a good thing, and I certainly would agree with you, but it wasn't Taragosa's intention. She was just trying to do as her father had commanded, to reunite the flight. She was basically Calagos's intended. They were supposed to get married. And then, supposed to mate. You know, dragons don't really do marriage as such. Consorts and so forth. Obviously, things went differently. Calagos ended up as head of the Blue Dragonflight. But we do see Taragosa again after that happens. Because at the end of Cataclysm, it's Taragosa who is giving us orders. Like when we go into the Wormrest Temple, it's Taragosa who's like, okay, there's a crazy guy. There's a big old tentacle face monster over there. There's another one over there. Really like it if you guys could go kill him while we defend the temple, because there's so much stuff attacking the temple right now. That's the last time we've seen Taragosa since. I don't think she's popped up since. I'm hoping she's in Dragonflight. And the reason I'm hoping she's in Dragonflight is for one reason. I want to differentiate her from Taragosa, who is, again, more like Kallak's little sister.
Correct.
And we don't want to see that get changed. I like the fact that he thought of her as a little sister. I don't think we're going to see Taragosa again, but I would not at all be upset if we did. I think that would be great. If we could get her out of the staff and give her life or whatever again, that would be really cool.
And we know that there's a precedent for that as well too, because we got to see that with Xalatath and N'Zoth and the exchange between the two, where Xalatath was released from the dagger. And yeah. Is a living entity, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So, yeah, I would like to see it happen. I don't know that it's going to happen. I have not come across any quests in the expansion when I'm going through the alpha. I have not seen anything about Taragosa mentioned, but I would like to see it. And I would like to see Taragosa come back, not to necessarily be Kallak's girlfriend, because I think that would be reductionist, but to harass him.
Or advise him at the very least.
Advise him in a harassing manner. Not harass him literally to bother him or hurt him. Just, you know, to be that kind of advisor who's like, yeah, that's a great plan. Why don't we just blow everything up? We can call it the Malfurion plan option. Blow it all up. Aces. You know, I feel like we need some dragons who are like a little bit less reverent, quite frankly. I've always liked that about Chromie. Chromie is in no way disrespectful, but she's very, her tongue is wedged real hard in her cheek.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that kind of character for dragons. I like dragons who don't take it too seriously. For every, Coriolis Strahs, there needs to be somebody a little bit less. Like, there needs to be an Azuragos. I'd love to see Azuragos come back, too. I would love to see Azuragos come back. I would love to see Azuragos as a character in Dragonflight, being the you know, playing the, oh my lord, are they doing this again? You know, his just long suffering death spirit dating dragony nutcase that he is. I love him. So yeah, I definitely hope we see more about the Blue Dragonflight. I definitely hope, I would love it if we get to see more about Terragosa. Mm-hmm. I would like to see all these other characters too. I know we're going to the library that Syndragosa had before she died.
That is correct, yep.
So that's one thing we know is going to happen. So yeah, more of that.
We're going to move on to a series of questions here from our friend Tolkienberg. Maybe not all of them, but definitely some of them at least. This was roughly Cthulhu equals Cthulhu, Yogg-Saron equals Yogg-Sothoth, Nazoth equals Nihiloth.
I disagree entirely with that, but we'll get into that once you're done.
I was just going to say, I'm sure Matt has comments about this. Considering these naming conventions, we've always considered Azeroth is just a nice titan in the making, yet her name is very close to Azathoth. Is it possible that she's already fallen? So I'm going to let Matt go, because I know he has opinions.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. I mean, well, we don't know. It certainly doesn't seem like she is, but, you know, it could be. Who knows? But I don't agree that Azeroth is intended to be an Azathoth thing. Maybe it was at first, because, you know, it might have been a reference that they were making while they were doing the game. But considering Xerath Mortis, we've now seen that. I think Azeroth is supposed to look like Xerath, or Xerath was created to look like Azeroth.
Azeroth, right.
Yeah. And I don't disagree that C'Thun was inspired by Cthulhu, or that Yogg-Saron is a reference to Yogg-Sothoth. But Nazoth, if it is a reference to Nyarlathotep, is the worst Nyarlathotep reference I've ever seen. Because here's the thing. C'Thun and the others like him were great old ones. I mean, Cthulhu. Cthulhu and Yogg-Sothoth and so forth, they were great old ones. They were not the same as Nyarlathotep. Nyarlathotep was the voice of the outer gods.
Yeah.
He was essentially, he's the Metatron for Azeroth, for Azathoth, because Azathoth was wild, burbling, nuclear chaos. Azathoth could not talk to you. The concept of having a conversation was not something Azathoth had, because Azathoth did not have concepts. There wasn't enough discrete sapience in Azathoth for him to have urges or opinions or drives. Those were not things he did. It did. They did. Even calling it a he or an a or an it doesn't really work, but got to call it something. So I'm going with it or they. Nyarlathotep was the black man with the horn, the witch's god, the bringer of light. The whole point of Nyarlathotep was that he brings illumination that will destroy you. He is the outer god of secrets you shouldn't learn, things you shouldn't know. That knowing this is not good for you. It is actually actively bad. He's a personification of that whole idea that I think most people have today about the Cthulhu mythos, that it will may drive you mad to know too much. And to give you an idea of something that in the poem, Nyarlathotep, Lovecraft straight up said that the nuclear bomb was one of his gifts. That was something he gave to us, that he let us learn. Nazoth is not that, but I can see why you might think he's meant to be a parallel to it, in that Nazoth is constantly talking about, you know,
the gifts bringing he's given.
Us, yeah, gifts. If anything, Nazoth reminds me very much of Shub-Niggurath.
Yeah.
The black goat of the woods with 1,000 young. That's more Nazoth-y to me. But, I mean, keep in mind the Lovecraftian stuff, the Cthulhu mythos, is an inspiration for these characters, but it's not a one-for-one parallel. They're not sitting down and saying, okay, we need to convert, you know, we don't have a name converter and we're just converting them one-to-one. There's not going to be a toad one named Tshag-Utha, you know, they're just not going to do that. It's better to think of them as similar ideas. If anything, the old gods from Warcraft are more like the outer gods from Lovecraft than they are the great old ones. And that's basically what I think is important to consider when we're thinking about the whole idea that Azeroth might already be fallen. I think it's more of a line that Azeroth might not be a titan.
Yeah.
The thing that Azeroth is might be beyond a titan. And what does that mean if it's true? What does it mean if Azeroth isn't what we thought it was? That it's beyond that it's even more important. The fact that Azeroth and Xerath Mortis seem linked to the point where all that stuff in Ice Crown was created to create a bridge between the soul of Azeroth and Zareth Mortis. Like, why? Like, obviously the jailer thought that this was going to be part of his masterstroke to reorder reality. Why is it necessary to touch Azeroth to do that? Why do you need Azeroth's power to reshape reality?
And specifically, why do you need to assault it and break it down? Because don't forget, during the encounter, it's Azeroth fighting back against the jailer, or in this case,
he doesn't even have a drop. Right? He's even got a drop that's like the, it looks like the heart of Azeroth.
It does. It absolutely does.
Yeah. And I keep thinking about this. I think someone else has mentioned this, might have been Joe, might have been somebody else, but that idea that, you know, it's quite possible that the reasons that the grave of the first ones, the sepulcher of the first ones, the resting place of them, the links tomb, to Azeroth, is that Azeroth's reality, everything they made around Azeroth's reality, might basically be the equivalent of what we saw at the end of like the mythology of Diablo with the Diamond Warrior, Anu, and Tathamet. What if they ripped everything out of themselves that was wrong, that they didn't feel fit their creation, thus dying, and then set up a bridge into their creation where they would go? And that's where they are right now. There's the final Titan is a first one, or the first ones. Maybe they're all in there as one being now, one perfect being that they intended the entire universe to serve as a creche to. That we'd be born into that world and part of it. And the thing that's coming, the strange force that's not the void, that's not anything we know today, might actually be what they pulled out of themselves. Mm-hmm. This is just one possibility. I don't know. It could be lots of other things, but I definitely think there's a connection between Zareth Mortis and Azeroth. There's a connection between what the jailer was trying to do and what the first ones did. I feel like he went backwards. He tried to reverse what they did. He was trying to pull them back to him so he could use their power to change things the way he wanted them to be.
Because that's what was trying to happen, right? It was trying to be a siphon.
He was trying to draw something out of Azeroth to himself and use it to reshape reality. Why can it do that? Why is what's in Azeroth necessary for that? Why was it working? Because it was working. If we didn't stop him, it would have worked. That's something I think is really important in this subject. That's what I would say on that front. But I don't think it's as simple as, you know, Azeroth is already corrupted. I think if anything, it's that Azeroth is way more complicated than we understand.
Possibly way more complicated than the old gods understood as well, too. Because think about this as well. We've already had a couple experiences that sort of, I don't want to say they hint at it, because they pretty much bop you on the head with it like a rolled up newspaper. You have the encounter where you're going through, remember the scenario, you're going through Alduar again, and you're going there because Magni needed to go there because Azeroth was having a nightmare and needed to actually purge what was happening there. Well, if Azeroth was already corrupted in this particular case, why would they be having a nightmare about all the terrors and things that were potential to come? Right? What we were fighting dark tentacles. We were fighting faceless ones. We were fighting servants of old gods. And if they were already done in their work, why would the old gods be so willing to, I don't want to say willing to die, but to make their presence known?
Yeah. Why bother doing all that if you've already accomplished? If anything, you'd want to keep people from looking too closely.
Exactly.
You don't want to draw attention when you've successfully done what you're trying to do. Like, what's the thing from Watchmen? I'm not a Republic serial villain, Dan. I wouldn't tell you what was going on if there was the slightest chance of you affecting its outcome. I did it 35 minutes ago.
Exactly.
The old gods have already corrupted her. They're not going to call attention to it until she's done being corrupted.
Versus, you know, let's go through the list. Like, C'Thun. We know that C'Thun didn't finish the job because even though C'Thun was awake, C'Thun had to call to its followers, whipping them up into a frenzy to not necessarily wage war, but to break down the barriers, to break down the walls so that they could become free again. If they were already like corrupt, if they had already succeeded, they wouldn't care. Their job would be done.
And similarly, they wouldn't have had C'Thun wouldn't have sent Cho'Gall up to Ulduar.
Yep.
And that's how those chains got broken around Yogg-Saron. That was Cho'Gall.
Correct.
Cho'Gall snuck in, and broke those chains. And once he did that, a lot of the stuff we see in Alduar, the Titan corruption type stuff, a lot of that comes from that moment.
Well, a lot of the corruption we see throughout Northrend comes from that moment. The the pools of Serenite that extend all the way as far as, like, well, everywhere, literally everywhere in Northrend. The Serenite are pieces of Yogg-Saron. It is liquefied Yogg-Saron corruption. I don't really know what else to call it. It's not necessarily his blood.
That's why it was such a great thing to take the Serenite and to make it into stuff that we wore on top of our heads and around our, you know, genitalia and so forth, to completely surround ourselves with Yogg-Saron. That was a smart idea.
And we know that was part of the plan. That's why that was the Ice Crown Citadel is made out of partially Serenite.
So is a lot of the big floating. When you go to Acherus is built on a Serenite framework.
And we know that all of a sudden, servants of the Old God in the Void were also assaulting the Shadowlands. Well, how did they know how to get there? How do they know what was there? How do they know what existed? When did it happen? We don't have a time frame for this. It could have been happening 10,000 years ago. It could have been happening 1,000,000 years ago. It could have been happening 10 years ago. So it's all about that long play as far as that goes. And Nazoth was able to influence things well outside its containment. If they were already successful or close to successful in their corruption, they wouldn't have had to. They wouldn't have had to call for their servants. They wouldn't, in this case, Nazoth wouldn't have had to make Queen Ashara do anything. And yet, here we are. Now, to bring it back to the naming conventions, I think that story-wise, I don't think that there's anything really anymore that links them all together. But I do think that the original inclusion of the Old Gods was a reference to the Outer Gods. It was a reference to the Old Ones from the Cthulhu mythos. But I think over time that has evolved, that they have evolved into sort of their own iconic things. As to what Azeroth becomes now, maybe there was originally supposed to be something where we thought it was a Titan and it turned out, oh, oops, all Old God. But I don't think that's the case anymore. I think Matt is right on the money, where it's something that is a being that is more diverse, more complicated, more complex than we had originally conceived, that it is not a Titan. It is not corruptible in the same sense. We know that it is I don't want to say a childlike intellect, but its understanding and self-awareness is there, but it doesn't have full understanding of what it is. It is being born anew in a lot of ways, like what we saw in Shadowlands, and particularly in Ardenweald, where things are transformed and molded. And I don't think that's I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that is intentional. And I think the things we saw in Shadowlands are intentional because of the path that we walked through. Think about it. The first thing we experience is the middle ground, the in-between of everything. It is just the portal, the gateway that leads to the other realms. There really is no rhyme or reason there. There's no feeling there. It is just a mechanical entity that is supposed to divide souls. From there, we go to where there is the sense of duty, where duty is everything. Who you are, your memories of who you were before are gone. They've been pulled out of you. Okay, let's make a note of that. The next place we go is where? We go to Ardenweald after that, right? It's Maldraxxus, then Ardenweald, right? I'm looking at you, Matt. I'm trying to remember the flow.
Okay, sorry. Repeat it.
After Bastion, where do we go? I can't remember if it's Ardenweald or if it's Maldraxxus. I think it's...
No, it's from Bastion, it's Maldraxxus.
Okay.
And from Maldraxxus, it's Ardenweald. And from Ardenweald, it's Revendreth. It's actually... The reason that we go to Maldraxxus is because Maldraxxus forces are attacking Bastion.
And we try to find out why. That's correct.
Yeah. Sorry. And then when we're near the end of Maldraxxus, that's when they're like, you got to go back to Ouroboros and tell them what's going on. And when you get there, they're like, okay, the only person left to contact is the Winter Queen. Well, so that's where you go there. So,
yeah. The idea is that you go to a sense of duty where memory is removed. You go to a sense of duty where who you are is valued, but not in so much as what you can do to the defense and protection of your realm and those souls in your charge. From there, you go to where things are reborn or repurposed based off of necessity, where we see that old gods the wild gods, and the sort of these primal figures Loas and such can, while they die, they can be reinfused and sent back to their worlds so that they may be reborn again and complete their tasks. But they don't necessarily remember their time there. They just know that they rest for a while. They know that they slept for a while, and then they're back again. They know that there's a cycle. We know this from the Ursoc short. And then we go to Revendreth, where your sins are pulled from you. Your extra baggage are pulled from you to make you more perfect of a servant would be not necessarily wrong, but it's not completely right. But all of these things, I think, are reflected, to go back to what Matt said. What going to the Sepulchre, finding out what Zaval was doing, leads at least me to believe that maybe Azeroth having that connection, these were experiments the first ones were doing to pull aspects of themselves out that they didn't like, to maybe create a more perfect being. Azeroth maybe doesn't have a memory of their past because it's been pulled from them. Azeroth is a child without sin because it's been pulled from it, potentially. Azeroth has a strong sense of preservation for itself and its children. We see it in the encounter with Zaval. Azeroth empowers us through that connection so that we can continue to fight. But we've also seen it in the past as well, where Azeroth has sort of reached out through Magni or other means to defend itself, to react, to do things. Not perfectly, but it has that sort of concept there. There's one aspect that hasn't been pulled off yet, which is, well, Azeroth isn't quite born yet. So I like the idea that maybe Azeroth started as one thing, but now that we know about Zareth Mortis and over years, I think maybe it evolved so that it's something greater, it's something bigger, it's not a titan, it's not a god, but we don't know what it is. And I think there's a certain amount of joy to that, that sort of trying to the unknowing nature of it. So... anything else you want to add to that one, Matt?
No, I think we covered it.
But I think that's going to do us on time. Tokenberg, thank you very much. We still have more of your questions to go through because you are very inquisitive this week. But I do want to thank you all for joining us. Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/blizzardwatch. Your continued support means this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, better chance of having your question answered on our podcast, or the Q&A ads free site experience. Again, if you have questions for this or any of our podcasts, be sure to send them into podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Specify the show there for, and you can also send in themes or topics that you want us to do episodes on, and we'll see what we can do. If you don't want to send an email, you can also hit us up on our Discord server. We have one channel set aside for our Patreon subscribers. It's Patreon Q and podcast questions. We tend to look there first before anything else. That's where several of these questions came from today, as a way of saying thank you for supporting us. And if you can't support us on Patreon, we understand, but you still want to participate in the show, go ahead and send those questions into the Q and podcast questions channel. And again, specify the show that it's for so that Matt and I don't have to thumb wrestle for. With that, folks.
Yeah, my thumb's freakishly long.
You don't want
anything to do with this thing.
It's true. It really is. But with that, folks, we'll see you next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.